Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology, which is powered by Pacifica. I'm Bonnie Bright, and this series is dedicated to bringing you discussions with individuals who are contributing to and through the field of depth psychology in some really important ways. And my guest today is Anne Taves, who is a professor of religious studies and who focuses on religious experiences, and particularly a topic that we're going to be talking about today, where religious experiences and depth psychology intersect. Anne is also going to be presenting at the upcoming Trauma and Transcendence Conference at Pacifica, which is happening in June of 2018. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Anne.
Yeah, glad to be here.
I'm very glad to have you here. It's going to be a fascinating discussion. Of course, spiritual experiences, religious experiences, and depth psychology are, in fact, quite intertwined. But before we jump into the conversation, let me first read your bio so that everyone has additional background on you. Anne Taves, PhD, is Professor of Religious Studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where she teaches courses on religious experience, new religious movements, and comparative worldviews, and supervises the Interdisciplinary Religion, Experience, and Mind Lab group. She's the author of numerous books and articles, including Fits, Trances, and Visions, Experiencing Religion, and Explaining Experience from Wesley to James, and Religious Experience Reconsidered, and Revelatory Events, a study of the emergence of three new spiritual paths, Mormonism, Alcoholics Anonymous, and A Course in Miracles. She is currently working with collaborators to develop and test a cross-cultural inventory of non-ordinary experiences. So Anne, lots of really juicy stuff to dig into here, and non-ordinary experiences not being the least of them, but let's begin with the conference. As I mentioned, you are going to be speaking at the Trauma and Transcendence Conference, which takes place in June at Pacifica. And for those who are listening and would like to know more, of course, you can find out more by going to pacifica.edu and clicking on the events tab and then the retreat at Pacifica. You'll see the conference listed there. At that conference, Anne, you're going to be speaking about spiritual, anomalous, and psychotic experiences. I'm wondering if you can start us off by expounding on those and sharing how you define each of those.
Well, actually, I don't define them. I often start my talks on this topic by talking about how three different disciplines define these terms. So I start with psychiatry, psychology, and religious studies, and I like to post pictures of three different books representing each discipline's attempts to diagnose, to understand these different phenomena. So for the American Psychiatric Association, we have their Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. For religious studies, I like to put up William James' Variety of Religious Experience. And then for the American Psychological Association, I put up a more recent book that plays off of William James's book called Varieties of Anomalous Experience. And I put them up in order to point out something about the content of these three volumes and these three traditions of diagnosis and interpretation of experience, which is not that they identically overlap, but there's an awful lot of overlap of some kinds of experiences that fall under all three of those categories. And that's what really interests me. The experiences that could be characterized as any one of those things.
So that's really interesting. And what it takes me back to, in some ways, is what I understand about shamanic initiations. And that is that sometimes when somebody is called to shamanism, for example, and they have some kind of an experience, it may look to our culture or to some other cultures like a psychotic experience. But in fact, it could actually be either very religious / spiritual, or it could be something very related to that calling. And I think that often indigenous peoples or the tribe around them would relate to it in that way, whereas we might relate to it in a very different way. For example, a Jungian analyst might relate to it differently than a psychiatrist might relate to it. Is that what I'm understanding from what you're saying?
Absolutely. And if we take off the psychiatric, the depth psychological, and the shamanistic language, and we just look in a generic kind of way, or we describe as generically as we can what that individual that you are thinking of might be experiencing. They might be having visionary experiences. They might be hearing a voice. They might be having an out-of-body experience. And each of those described just in terms of what's happening could wind up in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual as a dissociative disorder or a hallucination, could wind up in the Anomalous Experience book in a chapter on anomalous self and identity experiences, and could wind up in anthropology or religious studies under the heading of shamanism.
Right. So essentially, however, they're all a similar experience, and in some ways it really is based on how we perceive it and also how we hold that kind of experience. But I can imagine that when a person is going through some of these experiences, that it can actually be quite traumatic. I know that in some language, Stan Grof particularly introduced a term called spiritual emergency, which essentially, as I understand it, is when something spiritual happens to you, but it creates an emergency because maybe you don't know how to deal with it, or you don't have some kind of a framework in which it can work for you or fit for you. What kinds of states or outcomes do these kinds of experiences initiate in your experience, and what is to be done about them then? How can they be dealt with or addressed?
Well, I think there's a variety of answers to that. I mean, in many cultures and traditions, there are expectations around certain kinds of experiences. So in the example that you were thinking of with shamanistic practices, oftentimes people having certain kinds of distressing experiences can be a signal to a teacher that the spirits are trying to interact with them, and it might initiate some kind of process, actually, of initiation and training. In other contexts, like you were mentioning with Stan Grof and the spiritual emergencies, that's often a situation where people will have a traumatic experience. Perhaps they were doing some kind of practice, but they weren't doing it in a very structured situation. They didn't have much guidance. Things can go off the rails. So there's a variety of outcomes that are possible. And part of what is so fascinating to me about this is that how we interact with the experiences, how we appraise them, the kind of context in which we have them and the context that structure them, can very much affect the outcomes. I don't know that that's always the case, but it seems that there's a lot more room for how we interact with experiences to affect the outcome than we may think.
So I'm really curious, because the first example that came to me was the one about shamanism, but you've done really extensive research in this field, and so obviously you've seen a lot of different scenarios or encountered people who have had various experiences. Are you able to share some stories with us, or can you think of a couple of other more concrete examples that we can add to the mix here as we're talking about the things that happen when these kinds of experiences occur?
Yeah. Maybe this would be a good point to say a little bit about our inventory of non-ordinary experiences, because it's designed, we tried to include a very broad range of experiences that people sometimes in some traditions would consider spiritual or religious, but many of these items can also be found on parapsychology surveys or surveys of near-death experiences, and many of the items are also ones that you would see in psychiatric or inventories of psychosis. So many of the items that we put in the inventory can be appraised in multiple ways. And we've got 80 items on here. So I can give you some others, for example. I already mentioned the out-of-body experience. We've got another one. I've had an experience in which it seemed like there was another self in my body. That would be something that could be appraised as dissociative by a psychiatrist. or mediumship or channeling or spirit possession by an anthropologist. But we've also got a number of experiences that some people might put under the mystical heading. So I've experienced feeling that I was part of a greater unity or oneness. I felt a sense of connection with everything around me. I've had an experience in which the boundaries or separation between myself and the things around me seem to blur or disappear. That one's kind of interesting, I think, because that description is one that a Buddhist teacher identified as one of the two types of non-dual experiences that people in the kind of Buddhist practice that he teaches are seeking to have. It's also a pretty accurate description of ego dissolution, which researchers who are investigating psychosis see as one of the characteristics of psychosis.
Right. Yeah, so you bring up a really interesting point here, and that is that in some cases, individuals are actually seeking to have an experience like an ego dissolution because they feel or value that ego is secondary to a larger self, let's call it in Jungian terms,
right,
and that they want to be more in contact with that. And yet some people who are not necessarily seeking that experience or even know much about the fact that it could happen probably experience such an experience way more as a trauma than the others would. Can you expound on that a little bit and share why that might be and what should be done in each of those cases?
Well, I'm not a clinician, so I'm not in a position to give therapeutic advice here, but certainly experiences can occur either spontaneously or in a context where people are seeking them. And it's really hard to give general advice on that. I think one of the things to know, though, is that some of the things that we tend to think of in our culture as pathological, because in our culture, psychiatry and psychiatric concepts are, you know, very widespread in the culture, that we tend to assume that things are more unusual than they are and more problematic than they are. So, for example, so-called hallucinations or even hearing voices, which psychiatrists would tend to worry about quite a bit, are actually quite common in the general population, and for most of the people who have them, they don't cause any particular problem. They're just a somewhat unusual experience. So part of the problem with the different fields is that they've tended to become too isolated. You know, the psychiatrists look at the people that come to them for clinical help, and there's only a few who are then also looking at, well, how common would those experiences be in the general population? Because I've come at these questions from religious studies, I know that there are a lot of religious and spiritual movements that have gotten started because people had unusual experiences. And so from where I've started, it's impossible to assume that all this stuff could be pathological or a problem.
Right. And so then that brings us to a really important question that we've been kind of dancing around and have articulated a bit, but maybe it would be helpful at this point to articulate a little more explicitly. And that is the question of what role culture and religion actually play in these kinds of experiences.
Well, that's really one of the main questions that we want to explore with our inventory, because we're administering it online to large samples of people both in the United States and India. And what we want to find out is to what extent culture and religion, and I'm assuming the two are very deeply intertwined, so I don't tend to make a sharp distinction between the two. We want to find out the extent to which, in effect, cultural encouragement to notice or cultivate certain kinds of experiences is going to make certain experiences more frequent in one context than the other, and perhaps also lead to some of the different types of experiences being clustered together in patterns that might reflect practices in one culture and not in the other culture. So part of what's interesting about starting with the U.S.-India comparison is that the dominant tradition in the U.S. is Christianity, The dominant tradition in India is Hinduism, and we're figuring that that could have a pretty big impact, at least on some experiences. But there may be others that it turns out occur with pretty much the same frequency in both cultures. And that will be interesting to see as well.
Yes, it seems like there's a lot of value in looking at these from an interdisciplinary standpoint. And I don't know that any of those three particular channels or fields that you've referred to are necessarily trying to do that or wanting to do that. I do know that certain people, for example, Lionel Corbett, whom I'm sure you know and who is also speaking at the Trauma and Transcendence Conference at Pacifica, has done quite a bit of research and has written books about how the psychological and the religious or spiritual aspects come together. But I'm wondering what you see as the value to actually exploring this at all. I guess part of that is about where you're going with the inventory that you've put together and the research that you're doing currently. What do you intend to take from that?
I think that the more that we learn about this middle ground or this common area where people have experiences that can be, I want to say, molded or developed or understood in a variety of different ways, that the more we understand about that, I think the more that we can actually help people to work with these experiences in ways that are actually helpful for them. I mean, where they may get new insights into themselves, or they may realize that something that's troubling them really isn't that big a deal, and other people have had that experience, and that we can normalize a range of things rather than necessarily having to medicalize or pathologize them. Actually, you know, we haven't really talked about why this is such an appropriate conference for Pacifica to be hosting. And I think that's actually a really important point that we ought to bring out, which is that depth psychology, in contrast to regular psychology or the psychiatric tradition or the Freudian tradition within psychoanalysis, depth psychology, as influenced so deeply by Jung, really does bridge between these different areas. Jung was very interested in these experiences. He had many of these experiences, and he really worked in his own self-therapeutic process. He worked on the boundary of these kinds of experiences. So, I mean, his Red Book is chock full of this kind of stuff and is a great example of someone working with unusual experiences, especially with, as he called it, his inner dialogue process, where he's having various characters like Philemon coming to life within himself. He's cultivating that and then interacting with him and others who do not seem to be him, even though he probably thought they were part of his larger self. So he's very much working on the boundary between psychosis, spirituality, and what you might call the paranormal.
Yes, and I definitely think that's one of the values of depth psychology is the capacity for it to really be a container for such experiences. And particularly, as you mentioned, in a society where we tend to medicalize or make things unacceptable, really, if they are irrational or not easily understandable. I think the value of normalizing, as you put it, or at least making them not so taboo, could be huge, particularly in our culture. This knowledge grew from the unconscious in whatever form that that is. It's important for not only the individual's individuation process, but also for our collective, I think, especially as we move further and further, it seems, into the whole idea of rational thinking and scientific thought and the idea that research has to be a certain way and that people have to be a certain way without allowing for these kinds of experiences to be part of normal everyday life, especially when we know that since the beginning of mankind, mankind has had these experiences, and so they certainly should not be so taboo or so stigmatized. Are you finding in general that the collective is becoming more open to these kinds of experiences, or do you think that that's something that has yet to really open up in the future?
The collective in terms of the general culture?
That's right.
I think there's some hopeful signs, and Tanya Luhrmann, who's the anthropologist at Stanford, who's going to be speaking in the same session with me, she's probably going to talk about the Hearing Voices movement, which she and I both think is a really exciting development. A lot of her research has been around hearing voices in various kinds of contexts, from vineyard evangelical churches to psychiatric clinics and homeless people. And this Hearing Voices movement is one that started in Europe with psychiatrists and people diagnosed usually with schizophrenia that encouraged them to actually listen to their voices and see what they had to say and when they emerged and find out what their story is, rather than simply trying to medicate them into silence. And I think this brings up one of the really crucial issues that I hope we'll be talking about at the conference, which is the extent to which some of these things are linked to trauma, and where understanding the parts of the self that may emerge in response to trauma and giving them voice, allowing them to be heard, can be a deeply healing process. So, you know, whether Jung's own unusual experiences were a product of trauma or not, he really modeled a process of engaging with the different parts of the self. And I think that's really important.
Absolutely important. And of course, that brings us to the idea of active imagination, which was one of his key tools, obviously, in the Red Book and beyond, to be able to engage with the things that were emerging from the unconscious or were emerging out of these non-ordinary experiences. Have you been involved at all to actually work with people with those non-ordinary experiences, or is your research fairly limited to observing it and collecting the data?
Well, I'm not a therapist, so not in that kind of clinical sense of working with it. But I got interested in this back in the mid-80s when there were a lot of people who were being diagnosed with multiple personality disorder. And I had a friend who had been abused as a child and who apparently had multiple personalities or dissociated identity, as they now call it. And I came from a very rational sort of family where that kind of thing was just, it never dawned on me that our minds could do that. And so through knowing her and hearing her talk about her experience, that was when the door first opened into the range of things that were possible. And so over time, I've talked to lots of people in just regular conversation through giving talks like this and teaching classes on experiential topics. And I've also explored some of these things, you know, on my own in a therapeutic setting. So it's not like all of this is totally foreign to me personally, but I don't come at it as a professional.
Yeah, I think I asked that question because I can just imagine the stories that you've heard and probably people that you've seen being able to work with it in different ways. And I realize that's probably a whole extension or maybe even another body of research altogether. But it's just so fascinating to me to think about what happens next once people have had or begun having these kinds of experiences. And so that's part of it. From that, actually, I'm wondering as we begin to wrap up here, what you feel or what you see the role of depth psychology, and particularly as it pertains to Jung, the kind of depth psychology that Pacifica is doing, how you see that it can maybe play a role in the future for working with individuals who are having non-ordinary experiences or for the body of non-ordinary experiences themselves. Is there a way that it can really provide a structure or that it can serve as a vehicle to further this work that you're doing?
Well, as far as I understand it, Pacifica is helping to keep Jung's legacy alive and also training clinicians who I assume, but I don't really know, are more working on the one-on-one kind of therapeutic model. Part of what I think is really interesting is when these larger quasi-self-help movements get going that may make some of this a little bit more accessible outside of the therapeutic context, but could still provide some kind of structured container where people can explore some of these issues. So, you know, Pacifica might be in a position to help facilitate and train people to foster broader cultural awareness. I'm not really sure, but for me, that would be an interesting question to explore in the context of the conference and talking to Pacifica students and people who've trained there.
Absolutely. It sounds very exciting. What is it, Anne, as we close here, what is it that you feel most excited about at this point with your work and the research as you move forward?
I'm really excited about testing our inventory because there's not much research that has tried to get at these issues on a broad scale across cultures. Most of the surveys have not been designed in a way that they separate the experiences from the appraisals, and they don't test them across cultures. So I feel like we know a fair amount from the clinical work about individual experience, but we don't know nearly as much about these broad cultural differences as it relates to experience. So I'm hoping that if we're able to develop this further, that we're going to actually help to learn something about that.
Oh, again, so exciting. I just think the topic is so rich and there seems like so much that can be done with it. And it's really great to see how far you've come already by developing the inventory and all of the body of research that you've done. So I think it's going to be a really exciting conference and I'm really looking forward to your presentation there. Again, I've been speaking with Anne Taves, PhD, who is a professor of religious studies and who also focuses, obviously, her research on religious experiences and especially religious experiences and depth psychology. And as we mentioned, Anne's going to be presenting at the upcoming Trauma and Transcendence Conference at Pacifica in June 2018. And to find out more about that conference, you can go to pacifica.edu and click on events. And then if you click on the retreat at Pacifica, you'll find the information there. And you can find out more about Anne. You can see several of her papers, which are posted on academia.edu. Just go there and look for her name, Anne Taves, T-A-V-E-S. And you can also, probably the easiest is to Google her name along with religious studies, and you'll find her page at the www.religion.ucsb.edu site. That's the University of California, Santa Barbara. Anne, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. It's been such a pleasure.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.
Learn more at pacificapost.com or at pacifica.edu.